Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking with Dean Sobel. He is the director of the Clifford Still Museum in Denver, Colorado. Right now, I would like to welcome Jack Leibowitz. He is the author of the book Hidden Harmony, The Connected Worlds of Physics and Art, published by Johns Hopkins University Press. And there will be a book launch tomorrow, July 11th at 7 o'clock at the New Concept Gallery at 610 Canyon Road. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
7 p.m., I believe.
7 o'clock it is. So you're an emeritus professor of physics and former chairman of the art department at Catholic University of America. Was your first love art or science?
Science. But I discovered art in 1966 in Aspen, Colorado. I was invited as a brand new assistant professor I was at the University of Maryland at that time. I was invited to the Aspen Center for Physics for a retreat. They have them every summer for invited physicists. And I had never been west of the Mississippi before that. And it was a revelation. And
What was the revelation? The landscape? Or
a life-changing experience. The light, the violet skies, and the feel of the air in the Rockies. And it was overwhelming. It's not the East.
It is not the East, indeed.
The East. And that started my involvement with art. I began to work with charcoals and pastels, but more important, to learn how to see. And I've been looking at art ever since.
Now, did you find that you had a gift for art, that you could draw, and that stuff came out of you didn't know you had?
To be immodest, I think yes, to some extent. You know, I still am involved with art. I'm now a pastelist, and I have taken lessons with our local wonderful artists, Anita West and Albert Handel. They travel all around the country, and they're very well-known artists. He shows at the Ventana Gallery at least once a year.
You write in your book, Hidden Harmony, about beauty, and beauty is found both in art and in science. And I'm asking you this as you, a scientist, what is the experience of beauty? What causes one to experience the feeling that something is beautiful?
I talk about that a bit in the book, and I'd like to try to find it. In the first chapter, I mention that beauty is a guide both in physics and art. And Henri Poincaré, French mathematician and physicist, commented on it. And his comments, I think, are pervasive, not only for physics but for art as well. Here, on page 7 it says, quoting him, "The basic research scientist does not study nature because it is useful to do so. He studies it because he takes pleasure in it, and he takes pleasure in it because it is beautiful." And this part's in italics. I mean the intimate beauty that comes from the harmonious order of its parts, and that a pure intelligence can grasp. That aesthetic judgment guides great discoveries in physics, as well as in art. And of course, philosophers have been thinking about what is beauty ever since the ancient Greeks. But that comment by Poincaré covers a part of the issue.
So what are some examples of beauty in science?
Well, Einstein's pioneering work is a good instance. He proceeded from the idea that the world has meaning. There were philosophers early in the 20th century who had a different view. But he's always had faith. He always had faith in the idea that the world is meaningful, and that you can ask questions of the quotes, the old man, he used to refer to it, that suggested that there were answers to those questions about meaning. And these questions, because of his genius, were generally important beginnings for new thinking. And the questions had to do with notions, not just of meaning, but beauty in nature. And in special theory of relativity, for example, such a question about meaning led to the idea of relativity. And then in general relativity, which supplanted Newton's idea of gravity, the same kind of thing arose.
Now, are you drawing a parallel between meaning and beauty?
The Poincaré comment comes in here. The harmonious order of the parts, subliminally, I think artists think the same way. And when Poincaré said that nature was beautiful, I think he meant it literally in those terms. And I guess I could say more about it.
So, well, nature is, it's funny, because nature is everything that we know. In, it seems like, in its beauty and its ugliness and its horror and its violence. Mm-hmm. It's not all harmony.
No.
By any means.
No. It,
and what does harmony even mean?
Well, I think when I think about it, I think about physical law. Physical law is remarkably meaningful. In the book, I talk about symmetry. And we all think of symmetry of objects. For example, your cup of coffee. If there were no handle and it were rotated by an invisible hand, you wouldn't know that it was turned, because it would be the same in all directions. We would say that has rotational symmetry. And if you put the handle on and do the same thing, now we have the problem that the symmetry is broken, in the sense that it's no longer rotationally symmetric. You can tell how many degrees it's been turned. Well, that sounds like a limited view of symmetry, symmetry of objects. And in fact, mathematicians have done quite a bit with that. The kind of symmetry I'm referring to is the symmetry of physical law. Now, we all learn in school that energy is conserved, that it can't be destroyed. And that seems not to be true, because it changes its aspect. It has different forms. But in fact, the total energy of a system doesn't change. And that's true for other kinds of things that have strong physical meaning. And I don't want to get too clunky about this, but momentum, if we understand what it means, and angular momentum, and even time symmetry. And what we mean is, when we apply this all to physical law, that physical law has a symmetry that's very profound. For example, if I have a laboratory and I do an experiment here, and then I move the experiment, translate it to another place, we don't expect physical law to change. The same is true if we do the experiments of the laboratory at different times. Or if we turn the laboratory to a different angle. Those symmetries are built into nature. And the strange thing that can be shown mathematically is that each one of those symmetries is tied to what we call conservation laws in physics. When we mention time symmetry, that's equivalent, and it can be shown, as I said, mathematically. That's the same thing as saying that energy can't be destroyed.
Now, hold that idea. How does it translate into art?
Well, in art, symmetry is extremely important. The symmetry that we might mention to start with is the symmetry of the blank canvas. Now, to make it simple to think about that canvas is going in every direction arbitrarily far. And if I put an object on that canvas and then blindfold you and move the object with my hand, you can't tell the hand had been there. Now the object's in a slightly different position. But we have no way of knowing that because there's no reference point against which to compare it. Now, this is symbolically like what an artist confronts with his blank canvas or her blank canvas, or for that matter, the blank page in literature, or the score for musicians. And breaking that symmetry, that first brushstroke, begins the opportunity to find meaning, broken symmetry meaning. And now it's the job of the artist not just to willy-nilly put other strokes on the page, on the canvas, but to find a coherence and a unity and an organic unity, which makes it, which we comment about in saying it's good composition or whatever. A painter would say it's simply the painting works. And when they say it works, they know what they mean.
Well, that's a huge question. You know, we know how we judge quality and what, you know, standards in science. We have standards of rigor. We have repeatability. You do an experiment. Other scientists try to disprove it by repeating it over and over again. And if it holds up, it holds up. How do you judge what works and doesn't work in art?
That's the difference between science and art. I don't pretend to try to convince the reader that they're the same thing. In fact, I point out that the art discussions and the physics discussions, as it happens, take place in alternate pairs of chapters. The similarities are discussed, but at the very beginning, just as you say, there's a distinction. An artist looks for the kind of unity that we talked about. And artists know when their painting works. They say, literally, it works or it doesn't work. And there's a whole tradition and understanding behind that.
I know.
In physics, to answer your question, though, in physics it's different. New ideas, new theories have to be compatible with what came before, consistent with what we know already. And prediction has to be quite literal. This is something people don't understand when they talk about the quantum more freely than a physicist is allowed to do. Newton, for example, with his gravitation idea, said that when you take two masses and you separate them by a certain distance, the force becomes weaker. He just doesn't say it becomes weaker. He says it becomes weaker as the square of the distance. In other words, twice as far, it's four times as weak. Not 1.9999. There's a strong reason why it should be 2.0 exactly in Newton. And that's why mathematics turns out to be important in physics, because prediction is extremely important. And the author of the idea can fall on his own petard very quickly. That's a distinction.
I think the whole question of truth, which is part of this conversation, is also a distinction, because the truth, you know, of the molecular structure of glucose is, that's not going anywhere. That's not changing. Truth in art is something that is something we recognize, but it's awfully slippery.
Yeah. Should we talk about the physical idea first? A physical idea, let's start here. People have talked about the development of physical ideas as like turning the layers, successive layers of an onion. I think it's more like a picture puzzle, but not the kind we know of. An infinite picture puzzle, no boundaries. And what's more, so there's an open-endedness about, quotes, truth. in science. The glucose is a fact, but a theory. It has an internal consistency, but as we expand the picture puzzle, an expanded view of what is comes about, and that's where the tentative nature is. I'll give you a homely metaphor. You start your picture puzzle and you see a little arc. Your theory is now called the theory of the arc. Now, in the next generation, they discover that that arc becomes a closed loop. So now, it doesn't disprove the old notion,
right?
But it's expanded, but not just expanded. It takes on new meaning. Now, if you can go further with this.
So an example would be, you can build a house with Newtonian physics, but then Einsteinian physics builds on that.
And Einstein's ideas had to be compatible in the limit in which Newton worked with Newton's theories. And yet what made them very valuable was that they went beyond. Now that little arc might have four holes inside. Now we have the button theory.
Right.
So the internal consistency is not lost, but our vantage point grows. And the thing about nature that most people believe, the physical world, most people believe, is that there's no end to it. It isn't as though we'll know ultimately what is. And that's what's gorgeous about it.
I think when you talk about, you know, the arc turning into the circle, turning into the buttons with the four holes, something that is easy to lose sight of is that science is a collection of metaphors, as is art.
Of course. We have to think metaphorically because we're very limited. And, well, of course, that becomes especially obvious in modern physics when we discover that the world of experience has been left behind a long time ago, and that the world of the quantum, the world at the level of the atom, where particles are waves and waves are particles.
You're not going to see that, and you're walking through the Santa Fe Bacon Company.
No, and you'll want metaphor to help you along the way.
Right. We're talking to Jack Leibowitz, author of the book Hidden Harmony, The Connected Worlds of Physics and Art, and he will be speaking tomorrow, Friday, at 7 o'clock at the New Concept Gallery at 610 Canyon Road. So you have put out this wonderful metaphor of the endless picture puzzle going in all directions, but we still haven't gotten to the question of truth in art. Why are some artists great and, you know, express truth that lasts for through the ages, and others kind of die out like an extinct species or something?
It's a very individual kind of question.
Is it?
To some extent, there are artists that were very, very lionized in their time, and we don't even think about them anymore. On the other hand, there are others who maintain their currency. Some of the Impressionists.
Or who were thought to be ahead of their time.
You know, I like Renoir among the Impressionists. I like others too. But the reason I mention him is that there are people today who don't think much of Renoir. Cézanne. There are many people, I think, who would, in thinking about the Impressionists, would say that their favorite is Monet. Well, my favorite is Cézanne, who became a post-Impressionist, too. There are more stark examples. In 1434, Van Eyck made a painting that's very well known. It's the marriage of Arnold Fini, the Arnold Fini wedding. And if you look at that, you might say, well, I don't like that. Very lugubrious groom and pregnant bride and all of that. But that painting is a master of composition. Masterwork of composition, I suppose I should say. So... That's a hard question.
It is a hard question. It's one I was an art history student way back in the day, and it may not even be the most important question, but it does seem to come up when you have these whole issues of objective truth in physics, and then you're making parallels to art.
Cubism, analytical cubism, 1907 or 8 until 1912. Braque and Picasso were the prime movers, especially in that particular period. I love it, but there are people who don't like analytical cubism, don't like cubism. It's so rich and beautiful. But, well, and let's take Jackson Pollock. Now, he doesn't have many fans among the general populace, but in Washington, D.C., the East Building of the National Gallery, there's a Jackson Pollock called Lavender Mist, and it fills almost a whole wall. And there's a bench, and you can sit at the bench and spend as much time as you want. The bench is just the right distance away from that. Now, people sometimes have trouble with images that aren't literal. If you were to tell people you're really looking at a garden through a lattice work, that might make them happier. But it's a very abstract painting. And it turns out that it has a structure and a substructure and beyond that, it's remarkable. It's a wonderful painting. But my son went to visit with me there one day, and he said, being polite, "Why do you like that?" So I had to tell him why I like that. But it is very individual. Other people like that. It occupies the whole wall. It's probably one of his best paintings.
Jack Leibowitz is the author of the book Hidden Harmony, The Connected Worlds of Physics and Art, published by Johns Hopkins University Press, and he will be at 610 Canyon Road at the New Concept Gallery tomorrow at 7 o'clock in the evening. For more information at New Concept, you can call them at 795-7570. Jack Leibowitz, unfortunately, it's time to go, but thanks so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
We're going to take a little break right now, and when we come back, we'll be talking about the artist Clifford Still. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome, joining us by telephone, Dean Sobel. He is the director of the Clifford Still Museum of Denver, Colorado, and he will be the keynote speaker during the Art Santa Fe weekend on Saturday, July 12th at 6:30 at the St. Francis Auditorium in the New Mexico Museum of Art on the Plaza. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Let's talk about the artist Clifford Still, American artist born in 1904 in North Dakota, grew up in the Pacific Northwest. What were his beginnings as an artist?
Well, as an artist, he was really discouraged to be one. He grew up in a farming family in the Pacific Northwest, and painting just wasn't a kind of profession that at least his father thought was a worthy endeavor. So he really did it against probably all odds, being in a farming family and being discouraged to be an artist at every turn.
And then he went on to found an artist's colony.
Well, he was very active and very independent. So he sort of moved through San Francisco, where he was a very important teacher. When he finally moved to New York in the very early 1950s, he was part of a short-lived sort of artist school colony, you might say. He himself in the 30s spent some time at what is called Yadu in New England. So he was very much, sort of testing the waters of many different places and many different scenes. Even spent some time in Virginia in the mid-40s. So he was a person that was sort of covering all points of the United States.
How did he develop the work for which he's best known? And people use the labels abstract expressionism, uh-huh, color field painting. How did he develop that?
Well, it's interesting. And he and many of his contemporaries, I think, first knew that in order to be successful and original artists, they needed to abandon European pre-World War II modernism. So I think as much as that was known to Still, I think he certainly identified that following in Picasso's footsteps or Matisse's or the Surrealist footsteps was not the way to success. I think what's interesting also about this generation, and Still in particular, and we see this so well in the collection that are coming to Denver as part of the museum, is not only sometimes false starts, where you see an artist moving in one direction and then backing the truck up a bit and going down another avenue, but is what wasn't interesting to the artist, what he starts to abandon along the way. And I think particularly for the abstract expressionist, representation or truthful representation that a photograph might render was certainly limiting to an artist who was interested in more higher pursuits, I think, for painting.
Talk about those higher pursuits. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think I think narrative art, you know, art that wants to tell a single story or you know, record something in a direct way, is best handled with a kind of representational or realistic or, you know, figurative style. But when an artist, and I think particularly someone like Clifford Still, is trying to articulate themes or ideas or things that are not even knowable in a philosophical sense, representation art just simply isn't valid or useful. So the idea of turning to a new kind of art making, a new painting, that was eventually called abstract expressionism, seemed the most useful. So if you're trying to make a painting that is about an emotion or a feeling or a pervasive commonality in all of us as humans, you know, capturing that in a single image, realistic image, is going to be futile, where a more open-ended abstract language seems to us now, and I think to these artists then, more appropriate.
So there's an open-ended abstract language, and that raises the question, how much of that language is a shared language between the artist and the viewer? How much does the viewer have to bring to it, and indeed how much do they have to share with the artist in the first place in terms of speaking or understanding that language?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because I think what frustrates many people about whether it's modern art broadly or abstract art as a single subset of that, is that somehow they're missing something, you know, that they confront a painting and without a, you know, PhD in art history or a direct conversation with the artist, they're somehow not going to get it. But in my experience, both for myself and I think talking to other museum visitors being in the museum field, what they see and what they take away from a viewing of an artwork is not only valid, we should valid whatever experience they're having, but frankly, oftentimes correct in terms of what perhaps the artist's intentionalities were to begin with. So I think viewers should trust their first instincts. And I think particularly with art, the art of Clifford Still, which is highly evocative and looks like things that we do know from the seen world, whether it's the landscape and nature, the environment, even the human figure in some cases. I think we should sort of let those things in and then ask ourselves, you know, broader questions. And frankly, again, the answers we would have to those broader questions still would tell you are perfectly the right answers. They aren't about one thing. They're not closed systems. They're very open and, again, non-narrative. And so abstract art can be the most perfect way of conveying these more broad themes.
At the same time, the criticism from that period, you know, New York in the 1950s, the abstract expressionist period, seems to be really an integral part of the way at least the work has been seen and taught. And so to that extent, a lot of that work does seem to be mediated by criticism of its time and after that time.
That too is a really interesting question. And it's interesting you raise it, because there's an exhibition at the Jewish Museum in New York about the abstract expressionists that sort of addresses the movement through the eyes of the two most important critics of the movement, Clement Greenberg and Harold Rosenberg, who couldn't agree about anything and approached those works of art in entirely different ways. So, but then also over the years, almost every decade, new scholarship, revisionist readings have brought entirely new lenses in which to look at these paintings. So it's interesting that there really isn't a single approach or a single interpretation, nor would one want a single interpretation, but that the meaning of the pictures changes, I think, in some respects over time. And again, I think that's the case with all great art, that it isn't linked just to the period it was made, but has relevance and maybe new relevances based on, you know, our own contemporary eyes that are looking at it. But abstract expressionism is especially one that has been, you know, highly studied and written about in, you know, countless books and exhibition catalogs, and certainly there, no one would agree precisely about what, you know, all the intentions were, what an individual artwork is trying to communicate.
There's also, in abstract expressionism, a lot of variation among how the work, I think, is perceived by members of the general public who are not parts of the art world. For example,
yep.
I think that Mark Rothko's work is accessible to virtually everybody for mystical reasons that nobody can identify, but there it is. Whereas, and Clifford Still probably similarly, whereas somebody like Barnett Newman, a lot of people will look at it and shrug their shoulders.
Yes, although I agree with you maybe more so about Still, because I think Still's works are very evocative and very expressionistic, and they are many ways, you know, maybe not as quiet as a Rothko. But, you know, it's interesting, too, that I think a Rothko takes, you know, some effort to really experience, and Newman certainly. And I think it's almost up to the individual viewer and their own biases and prejudices, and, you know, particularly abstract art, where there's the lingering sense in some viewers that it doesn't have craftsmanship or skill, and only realistic art is, you know, a skillful enterprise. And it's, yeah, all of these issues, I think, are complicated, and unfortunately, I think, get in the way of actually looking at the paintings, because I think sometimes it's, you have to get through these other issues before you can really, you know, freely understand what the picture is saying to you. Or Pollock is the one, you know, the dripped and poured technique that, you know, a critic at the time in the 40s said, I have a hard time looking at these paintings because they make me want to comb my hair, you know. So there's all this references to banal things that are so removed from what the artist's intentions were. And, you know, that whole unfortunate adage, you know, my kid could do it. You know, a kid can splatter paint on a canvas, but I guarantee you, in fact, there was an article I saw once where they asked kids to make famous artworks, modernist and minimal artworks, and kids can't do it. But, you know, there are so many, I want to say prejudices, I think, in more so in modern and contemporary art than there might be in, you know, pre-1900 art that prevent people from actually getting a fair shake at what they're looking at.
Well, I mean, you just got done saying a few minutes ago that everybody's response is valid in some way. I think the combing your hair thing is pretty great.
But I think maybe we want to look a little harsher, yes. But you're right. Even that response is eliciting a response in a viewer, a sense of, you know, chaos and turmoil. And this is maybe a critic who really liked things neatly arranged. And, you know, given that abstract expressionism emerges in a time of enormous chaos, the Second World War and all that embodied, shouldn't the paintings have a certain sense of that as well?
We're talking to Dean Sobel. He is the director of the Clifford Still Museum in Denver, Colorado, which we're going to talk about in a couple of minutes. What is the significance of the fact that so many abstract expressionist works, including Clifford Still's, are so large in scale?
Well, that too is something I think we take for granted in our 21st century eyes. But the idea, well, twofold. I think the idea of making artworks that no longer were something we walked up to and peered into, like a small Vermeer, and you imagine what it's like to be in that Dutch interior, as opposed to abstract expressionist scale paintings, which were meant to be almost an experience and an environment in and of themselves, that you no longer just peered into it, but when in the case of Still you have, you know, canvases that are 9 by 13 or 14 feet, you experience them in a way that is more than just, you know, a kind of intimacy, but in fact something that becomes more about enveloping you in the same way that the artist experienced when they were making it. You know, they're sort of up close and examining all aspects of the canvas, and I think abstract expressionist paintings are about sort of changing the whole way we experience paintings. I think abstract expressionist painting also intentionally tried to mimic the scale of great church decorations, public murals, and what we might even call the scale of importance. So that scale embodied something that was heroic and timeless and significant. And given what their goals were in making those paintings and what their reference points were, I think scale was a very important part of abstract expressionism.
What was Clifford Still's relationship like with the art world? He broke away at a certain point.
Yeah, it was, and I think this has been over-mythologized in a way. I mean, the most important aspect of the answer to your question is that right at the moment that Still had assumed a very high regard in the international art world among artists and critics and collectors and museums and so forth, he immediately withdrew from it. I think there was something that he felt very uncomfortable being part of, being grouped together in a movement. The motives of all those people, whether it's critics or dealers, or I think he questioned. And although it seems like a radical act, sort of stepping out of the art world and doing it your own way, I think one could also easily say he just politely stepped back and let the others do it that way, and he was just going to do it his own way. But it had major significance in terms of, certainly his legacy, because he wasn't playing the marketplace and, the way reputations are built are often done through things such as playing the usual game. And I think especially after his death, when his wife decided to lock everything up, it really put a shroud of mystery and probably damaged the legacy of this incredibly important American artist, because there was virtually no access to it. You couldn't see 94% of everything he made, because that's what he had in his own possession when he died, and all the letters and photographs and archival material was sealed off as well. So it really closed off this American treasure that thankfully now Denver is making accessible once again.
Now, was that his decision? Was that something in his will, or was it his wife's intention?
It was actually in his will, and something that certainly was bubbling around in his mind by the 60s, and his will was written in the mid-70s, and he didn't die until 1980. So it was it was early in his career, but something that certainly started to, I think, dictate, aspects of, and he still was an artist. He was still making paintings and still doing museum exhibitions when he felt it was the right occasion. But it certainly influenced, I think, what he would let out of his studio, knowing that he was trying to keep this life's body of work together.
Why was he trying to keep it together?
I think simply he felt, and I don't think if you talk to other artists, they would necessarily disagree with this, he felt that there is a good way to see his art, an optimal way, and a less optimal way. And for Clifford Still, it was, one, to see it with other examples of his work, so in groups or several groups, and then, second, without the distraction of another artist. And it wasn't that he didn't want that artist in his circle or in his gallery. He just felt that the same should apply to his colleagues, and so that we shouldn't, as art historians like myself often do, understand an artist through comparisons to other artists, that an artist's work should be considered on its own terms and not in conjunction with schools or movements or isms. And again, that seems radical to us today, but I think if you really asked serious artists, they would agree with you that the notion of always being, especially in museums where we do this with great, great pride, always being juxtaposed or, considered alongside, or in some cases these movements are rather artificial anyways, yet we always group them together because tradition has told us to do that. So I think those were basically his motives, that he wanted his voice to ring true.
So now you are in this extraordinary position of being able to build a museum that reflects as best as you can piece together his wishes for having a single artist museum and having a huge amount of work be shown in one place.
Yep. Although we won't necessarily show it, I mean, we certainly won't show it all. So the experience of the Clifford Still Museum would be like walking through a retrospective at a large museum. In other words, it would be, maybe we're going to have, 12 or 14 galleries, most likely when we open, starting with the earliest work. The last painting you see will be his last works, and then in some cases interrupting that chronology with themes. But the intention is to sort of be able to tell the story in a way that is coherent and logical and, makes an impact and hopefully gets people excited and wanting to come back.
And so although the work in itself isn't narrative work, it's abstract work, there is, in the implication of what you're saying, a mm-hmm. kind of narrative to the whole body of work.
Well, there's certainly, and again, I think in any artist's work, there's certain things that artists are trying to achieve or trying to do. And I think, again, particularly in the work of great artists, there's a kind of common thread that runs through, if not all of it. I think we tend to go back to his, you know, juvenilia and say he was already thinking about these ideas when he was 17 years old. That may be pushing it. But I think certainly by the late 1930s, we can already identify themes and even imagery and physical approaches to painting that he carries through until his very last works. And I think that's really, you know, the essence of the artist, and that's what we'll try to bring to the forefront in these first exhibitions.
The museum is slated to open in 2010, is that correct?
That is correct.
It must be an amazing project for you, for architects, for museum designers, creating spaces that are not just for art in general, but presumably even for specific paintings.
Yeah, exactly. I think art museum architects have a really hard job because usually they're designing spaces that for 3 months will have one kind of art, let's say big things, and then the next show is going to be small things, and then the next show is going to be two-dimensional things, and then small, you know, gold things, and none of those could be optimally displayed in the same room because the rooms just need to adapt for the art shown in it. And in the case of a single artist museum, and particularly a single voice, the art of Clifford Still, we can really change that around and ask ourselves, what's the best way to show these paintings? What's the best proportions, the best ceiling heights, the best wall colors, the best, you know, sequence, pauses, light conditions? And that's really challenging but greatly enjoyable, being able to design a building around a specific collection like this. And
now,
you know, great challenge, but one that I think we're solving in ways that will be very impactful.
Why Denver?
That's a good story, or not even a story. It really was Still's second wife's choice of an American city. It had to go to an American city, and it was a gift. It's a bequest, so it is a gift to the people. Denver competed for it like virtually every major American city at one time since the early 1980s, when the estate was more or less settled and a city could start to be identified, although Mrs. Still didn't really actively pursue it. She just waited for people to approach her. Denver was selected, I think, mostly because the mayor and other people involved here assured Mrs. Still that it would be done precisely as her and her husband had always envisioned and hoped. And then I think the way Denver so easily, our mayor, John Hickenlooper, so easily identified the importance of not only the artworks, but the importance of what this means for a city like Denver and its rising international presence. Still doesn't have a direct relationship to the city of Denver, although he did teach a summer session in Boulder at the University of Colorado in the early 60s. But there is something about, and he did spend the first 45 years of his life on the West Coast, mostly in Washington State and San Francisco. But there is something about his pioneering spirit and even the broad expanses of color that some critics and viewers relate to the broad landscape here in the West that makes Denver not a bad place physically to let Still's voice ring true.
What did Clifford Still want in terms of an audience? What did he hope for someday to have a museum in which thousands or millions of people, including, you know, just the masses, the public, the non-art world, would see his work?
Yeah, it's interesting, too, and I was just reading, I don't think artists or famous people necessarily are interested in fame or the, you know, the number of people that see the work. I think it's the quality of the experience and the ability to confront the work as of art. I think artists are probably less upset when someone doesn't like the art or opposes the artist's intentions, at least they've seen the work. And I think Clifford Still, as much as he did, and his second wife, certainly, you know, kept it under wraps. There was always the intention that these works should be seen. So I think for Still, it was more a case of having these accessible, and people will, most people will enjoy it, some will not, and that the work is clear and honest and you know, doesn't need much more than that. Some viewers may prefer more than that, but I think it's that direct, you know, dialogue between visitor, regardless of age or regardless of familiarity with art history, and that artwork. So I think his aspirations were rather modest and simple. He wasn't trying to make it be, you know, the highest attended museum in the city that it became. Those simply were not his aspirations.
Now, you just were saying this was a gift from his estate. Did it also include the money to build the building, or do you have
No.
to go about raising that?
Yes. The collection is indeed a gift to the city of Denver, and the monies to plan, which is, you know, the phases we're still in, and design and build, which we're very much in, and then eventually operate and endow the Clifford Still Museum, will all be raised through private sources, either through foundations or federal agencies or individuals. So and that's not so unusual in the museum world, but there is a kind of bifurcation between what is public. The collection will always be a city asset, if you will. It will always be a part of the city's holdings, and then the city has set up its own 501c3 nonprofit, which we call the Clifford Still Museum. That will be the instrument, the legal term is actually caretaker of that collection, and without the benefit of any city funding, but also without the potential problems of having a city dictate what we do or don't do, or trying to get a percent of our revenues or whatnot. So it's we think we have a very best of all possible worlds relationship.
As director of the Clifford Still Museum, you probably have gotten to see and spend time with the work more than most people. How
Yes.
has it affected you personally?
Wow, that too is an interesting question. You know, you can't help but feel privileged. In many, many, many cases, you know, the paintings that I see have never been seen by anyone except the artist. Oftentimes, particularly in the last 20 years of his life, he made a painting and then rolled it up after it was reasonably dry. So by unrolling it for our purposes, you even get the smells of oil and turpentine kind of, you know, wafting up from the canvas. And I have to tell you, it's an extraordinary, it would be like opening King Tut's tomb,
right,
and being the first one in. It's you know, kind of spine tingling. In fact, it's very spine tingling because it's that special, you know, knowing that these masterpieces have been kind of sequestered away like King Tut's treasures, and that they will eventually get their due audience in Denver is, you know, thrilling.
Dean Sobel is the director of the Clifford Still Museum of Denver, Colorado, which will open in 2010, and he will be the keynote speaker during the Art Santa Fe weekend. This Saturday, he'll be here at 6:30 at the St. Francis Auditorium in the New Mexico Museum of Art on the plaza. For more information about Art Santa Fe, you can call 988-8883. And for tickets to the event on Saturday night, you can call the Lensic box office, 988-1234. Dean Sobel, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can reach me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. You can also hear the podcast at santafe.radiocafe.org, where the show is available any time of day or night, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Mary Lynn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz features Artist of the Month, McCoy Tyner. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte, and tomorrow Robert Knott and the great director Peter Sellers will be with us as well, and some folks from the folk art market, so that and much, much more on Santa Fe's only public radio station, KSFR. Hasta la vista. Ciao.